This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Crying of Lot 49 by Thomas Pynchon, narrated by George Wilson, and directed by Jeff Barron. This book is copyrighted 1965 and 1966 by Thomas Pynchon. This recording is copyrighted 2005 by Recorded Books. Not much is known about the life or whereabouts of Thomas Pynchon. Notoriously reclusive and enigmatic, there is from time to time very lively speculation about what he's up to by a loyal, even fanatical, readership. As one of the most original and important American writers, Pynchon's short but complex second novel is generally considered to be his most accessible. Originally published as a work in progress in Esquire magazine entitled The World, This One, The Flesh, Mrs. Oedipa Moss, and The Testament of Pierce Inverarity, Oedipa Moss's journey into a shadowy, alternate America, where coincidences accumulate suspiciously and the postal system takes on sinister overtones, has been hailed as a classic of postmodern literature. And now, The Crying of Lot 49.
Chapter 1. One summer afternoon, Mrs. Oedipa Moss came home from a Tupperware party, whose hostess had put perhaps too much kirsch in the fondue, to find that she, Oedipa, had been named executor, or she supposed executrix, of the estate of one Pierce Inverarity, a California real estate mogul who had once lost $2 million in his spare time, but still had assets numerous and tangled enough to make the job of sorting it all out more than honorary. Oedipa stood in the living room, stared at by the greenish dead eye of the TV tube, spoke the name of God, tried to feel as drunk as possible. But this did not work. She thought of a hotel room in Mazatlan, whose door had just been slammed, it seemed forever, waking up 200 birds down in the lobby. A sunrise over the library slope at Cornell University that nobody out on it had seen because the slope faces west. A dry, disconsolate tune from the fourth movement of the Bartók Concerto for Orchestra. A whitewashed bust of Jay Gould that Pierce kept over the bed on a shelf so narrow for it she'd always had the hovering fear it would someday topple on them. Was that how he died, she wondered, among dreams, crushed by the only icon in the house? That only made her laugh, out loud and helpless. You're so sick, Oedipa, she told herself, or the room, which knew. The letter was from the law firm of Warp, Wistful, Kubitschek, and McMingus of Los Angeles, and signed by somebody named Metzger. It said Pierce had died back in the spring, and they'd only just now found the will. Metzger was to act as co-executor and special counsel in the event of any involved litigation. Oedipa had been named also to execute the will in a codicil dated a year ago. She tried to think back to whether anything unusual had happened around then, through the rest of the afternoon, through her trip to the market in downtown Kinneret among the pines, to buy ricotta and listen to the Muzak. Today she came through the bead-curtained entrance around bar 4 of the Fort Wayne Settecento Ensemble's Variorum, recording of the Vivaldi Kazoo Concerto, Boyd Beaver soloist. Then through the sunned gathering of her marjoram and sweet basil from the herb garden, reading of book reviews in the latest Scientific American, into the layering of a lasagna, garlicking of a bread, tearing up of romaine leaves, eventually, oven on, into the mixing of the twilight's whiskey sours against the arrival of her husband, Wendell Mucho Moss, from work. She wondered, shuffling back through a fat deck full of days, which seemed, wouldn't she be first to admit it, more or less identical, or all pointing the same way subtly, like a conjurer's deck, any odd one readily clear to a trained eye. It took her till the middle of Huntley and Brinkley to remember that last year at 3 or so one morning there had come this long-distance call, from where she would never know, unless now he'd left a diary, by a voice beginning in heavy Slavic tones as second secretary at the Transylvanian consulate, looking for an escaped bat, modulated to comic Negro, then on into hostile Pachuco dialect, full of chingas and maracones, then a Gestapo officer asking her in shrieks did she have relatives in Germany, and finally his Lamont Cranston voice, the one he'd talked in all the way down to Mazatlan. "Pierce, please," she'd managed to get in. "I thought we had..."
"But Margot," earnestly. "I've just come from Commissioner Weston, and that old man in the funhouse was murdered by the same blowgun that killed Professor Quackenbush. Or something."
"For God's sake," she said. Mucho had rolled over and was looking at her.
"Why don't you hang up on him?" Mucho suggested sensibly. "I heard that," Pierce said. "I think it's time Wendell Moss had a little visit from the Shadow."
Silence, positive and thorough, fell. So it was the last of his voices she ever heard. Lamont Cranston. That phone line could have pointed any direction, been any length. Its quiet ambiguity shifted over in the months after the call to what had been revived. Memories of his face, body, things he'd given her, things she had now and then pretended not to have heard him say. It took him over and to the verge of being forgotten. The Shadow waited a year before visiting, but now there was Metzger's letter. Had Pierce called last year then to tell her about this codicil? Or had he decided on it later, somehow because of her annoyance and Mucho's indifference? She felt exposed, finessed, put down. She had never executed a will in her life, didn't know where to begin, didn't know how to tell the law firm in L.A. that she didn't know where to begin. "Mucho, baby," she cried in an access of helplessness. Mucho Moss, home, bounded through the screen door.
"Today was another defeat," he began.
"Let me tell you," she also began. But let Mucho go first. He was a disc jockey who worked further along the peninsula and suffered regular crises of conscience about his profession.
"I don't believe in any of it, Ed," he could usually get out. "I try. I truly can't."
Way down there, further down perhaps than she could reach, so that such times often brought her near panic. It might have been the sight of her so about to lose control that seemed to bring him back up.
"You're too sensitive."
Yeah, there was so much else she ought to be saying also, but this was what came out.
It was true, anyway.
For a couple years he'd been a used car salesman, and so hyper-aware of what that profession had come to mean that working hours were exquisite torture to him. Mucho shaved his upper lip every morning 3 times, with 3 times against the grain, to remove any remotest breath of a mustache. New blades he drew blood invariably, but kept at it. Bought all-natural shoulder suits, then went to a tailor to have the lapels made yet more abnormally narrow. On his hair, used only water, combing it like Jack Lemmon to throw them further off. The sight of sawdust, even pencil shavings, made him wince. His own kind being known to use it for hushing sick transmissions, and though he dieted, he could still not, as Oedipa did, use honey to sweeten his coffee, for like all things viscous, it distressed him, recalling too poignantly what is often mixed with motor oil to ooze dishonest into gaps between piston and cylinder wall.
He walked out of a party one night because somebody used the word cream puff, it seemed maliciously, in his hearing. The man was a refugee Hungarian pastry cook talking shop, but there was your mucho, thin-skinned. Yet at least he had believed in the cars. Maybe to excess. How could he not, seeing people poorer than him come in, Negro, Mexican, cracker, a parade 7 days a week, bringing the most god-awful of trade-ins, motorized metal extensions of themselves, of their families, and what their whole lives must be like, out there so naked for anybody, a stranger like himself, to look at, frame cockeyed, rusty underneath, fender repainted in a shade just off enough to depress the value, if not mucho himself, inside smelling hopelessly of children, supermarket booze, two, sometimes three generations of cigarette smokers, or only of dust, and when the cars were swept out, you had to look at the actual residue of these lives, and there was no way of telling what things had been truly refused, when so little, he supposed, came by that out of fear most of it had to be taken and kept, and what had simply, perhaps tragically, been lost. Clipped coupons promising savings of 5 or 10 cents, trading stamps, pink flyers advertising specials at the markets, butts, tooth-shy combs, help-wanted ads, yellow pages torn from the phone book, rags of old underwear or dresses that already were period costumes for wiping your own breath off the inside of a windshield with, so you could see whatever it was, a movie, a woman, or car you coveted, a cop who might pull you over just for drill, all the bits and pieces coated uniformly like a salad of despair in a gray dressing of ash, condensed exhaust, dust, body wastes. It made him sick to look, but he had to look. If it had been an outright junkyard, probably he could have stuck things out, made a career. The violence that had caused each wreck being infrequent enough, far enough away from him, to be miraculous, as each death, up till the moment of our own, is miraculous. But the endless rituals of trade-in, week after week, never got as far as violence or blood, and so were too plausible for the impressionable mucho to take for long. Even if enough exposure to the unvarying gray sickness had somehow managed to immunize him, he could still never accept the way each owner, each shadow, filed in only to exchange a dented, malfunctioning version of himself for another, just as futureless, automotive projection of somebody else's life. As if it were the most natural thing. To Mucho, it was horrible. Endless, convoluted incest. Oedipa couldn't understand how he could still get so upset, even now. By the time he married her, he'd already been 2 years at the station, KCUF, and the lot on the pallid, roaring arterial was far behind him, like the Second World or Korean Wars were for older husbands. Maybe, God help her, he should have been in a war. Japs in trees, krauts in tiger tanks, gooks with trumpets in the night. He might have forgotten sooner than whatever it was about the lot that had stayed so alarmingly with him for going on 5 years. 5 years. You comfort them when they wake pouring sweat or crying out in the language of bad dreams. Yes, you hold them. They calm down. One day they lose it. She knew that. But when was Mucho going to forget? She suspected the disc jockey's spot, which he'd got through his good buddy the KCUF advertising manager, who'd visited the lot once a week, the lot being a sponsor, was a way of letting the top 200, and even the news copy that came jabbering out of the machine, all the fraudulent dream of teenage appetites, be a buffer between him and that lot. He had believed too much in the lot. He believed not at all in the station. Yet to look at him now, in the twilit living room,
gliding like a large bird in an updraft toward the sweating shaker full of booze, smiling out of his fat vortex ring center. You'd think all was flat, calm, gold, serene. Until he opened his mouth. "Today, Funch," he told her, pouring. "Had me in, wanted to talk about my image, which he doesn't like." Funch being the program director, and Mucho's great foe. "I'm too horny now. What I should be is a young father, a big brother. These little chicks call in with requests. Naked lust to Funch's ear throbs in every word I say. So now I'm supposed to tape all the phone talk. Funch personally will edit out anything he considers offensive, meaning all of my end of the conversation. Censorship, I told him. Think, I muttered, and fled. He and Funch went through some such routine maybe once a week. She showed him the letter from Metzger. Mucho knew all about her and Pierce. It had ended a year before Mucho married her. He read the letter and withdrew along a shy string of eye blinks. "What am I going to do?" she said. "Oh, no," said Mucho. "You got the wrong fella. Not me. I can't even make out our income tax right. Execute a will? There's nothing I can tell you. See Roseman, their lawyer." "Mucho, Wendell, it was over before he put my name on it." Yeah, I meant only that, Ed. I'm not capable." So next morning, that's what she did. Went and saw Roseman, after a half hour in front of her vanity mirror, drawing and having to redraw dark lines along her eyelids that each time went ragged or wavered violently before she could take the brush away. She'd been up most of the night, after another 3-in-the-morning phone call, its announcing bell clear cardiac terror. So out of nothing did it come, the instrument 1 second inert, the next screaming. It brought both of them instantly awake, and they lay, joints unlocking, not even wanting to look at each other for the first few rings. She finally, having nothing she knew of to lose, had taken it. It was Dr. Hilarious, her shrink or psychotherapist. But he sounded like Pierce doing a Gestapo officer. "I didn't wake you up, did I?" he began, dry. "You sound so frightened. How are the pills? Not working?" "I'm not taking them," she said. "You feel threatened by them?" "I don't know what's inside them." "You don't believe that they're only tranquilizers?" "Do I trust you?" She didn't, and what he said next explained why not. "We still need 104th for the bridge." Chuckled aridly. The bridge, Debruka, being his pet name for the experiment he was helping the community hospital run on effects of LSD-25, mescaline, psilocybin, and related drugs on a large sample of suburban housewives. The bridge inward. "When can you let us fit you into our schedule?" "No," she said. "You have 500,000 others to choose from. It's 3 in the morning.
We want you."
Hanging in the air over her bed, she now beheld the well-known portrait of Uncle that appears in front of all our post offices, his eyes gleaming unhealthily, his sunken yellow cheeks most violently rouged, his finger pointing between her eyes. "I want you." She had never asked Dr. Hilarious why, being afraid of all he might answer. "I'm having a hallucination now. I don't need drugs for that."
"Don't describe it," he said quickly.
"Well, was there anything else you wanted to talk about?"
"Did I call you?"
"I thought so," he said.
"I had this feeling. Not telepathy, but rapport with a patient is a curious thing sometimes."
"Not this time." She hung up. And then couldn't get to sleep.
but would be damned if she'd take the capsules he'd given her. Literally damned. She didn't want to get hooked in any way. She told him that.
So, he shrugged. On me you are not hooked? Leave then. You're cured.
She didn't leave. Not that the shrink held any dark power over her, but it was easier to stay. Who'd know the day she was cured? Not him. He'd admitted that himself.
Pills are different, she pleaded.
Hilarious only made a face at her, one he'd made before. He was full of these delightful lapses from orthodoxy, his theory being that a face is symmetrical like a Rorschach blot, tells a story like a tat picture, excites a response like a suggested word, so why not? He claimed to have once cured a case of hysterical blindness with his number 37, the Fu Manchu, many of the faces having, like German symphonies, both a number and a nickname, which involved slanting the eyes up with the index fingers, enlarging the nostrils with the middle fingers, pulling the mouth wide with the pinkies, and protruding the tongue. On Hilarious, it was truly alarming. And in fact, as Oedipus' Uncle Sam hallucination faded, it was this Fu Manchu face that came dissolving in to replace it and stay with her for what was left of the hours before dawn. It put her in hardly any shape to see Roseman. But Roseman had also spent a sleepless night brooding over the Perry Mason television program the evening before, which his wife was fond of, but toward which Roseman cherished a fierce ambivalence, wanting at once to be a successful trial lawyer like Perry Mason, and, since this was impossible, to destroy Perry Mason by undermining him. Oedipa walked in, more or less by surprise, to catch her trusted family lawyer stuffing with guilty haste a wad of different-sized and colored papers into a desk drawer. She knew it was the rough draft of The Profession v. Perry Mason, a not-so-hypothetical indictment, and had been in progress for as long as the TV show had been on the air.
"You didn't used to look guilty, as I remember," Oedipa said. They often went to the same group therapy sessions, in a carpool with a photographer from Palo Alto, who thought he was a volleyball. "That's a good sign, isn't it?"
"You might have been one of Perry Mason's spies," said Roseman. After thinking a moment, he added,
"Ha ha."
"Ha ha," said Oedipa. They looked at each other.
"I have to execute a will," she said.
"Oh, go ahead then," said Roseman. "Don't let me keep you."
"No," said Oedipa, and told him all.
"Why would he do a thing like that?" Roseman puzzled after reading the letter.
"You mean die?"
"No," said Roseman. "Name you to help execute it."
He was unpredictable.
They went to lunch. Roseman tried to play footsie with her under the table. She was wearing boots and couldn't feel much of anything. So, insulated, she decided not to make any fuss.
"Run away with me," said Roseman when the coffee came.
"Where?" she asked. That shut him up. Back in the office, he outlined what she was in for. Learn intimately the books and the business, go through probate, collect all debts, inventory the assets, get an appraisal of the estate, decide what to liquidate and what to hold on to, pay off claims, square away taxes, distribute legacies.
"Hey," said Oedipa, "can I get somebody to do it for me?"
"Me," said Roseman. "Some of it, sure. But aren't you even interested?"
"In what?"
"In what you might find out." As things developed, she was to have all manner of revelations, hardly about Pierce Inverarity or herself, but about what remained, yet had somehow, before this, stayed away. There had hung the sense of buffering, insulation. She had noticed the absence of an intensity, as if watching a movie just perceptibly out of focus that the projectionist refused to fix, and had also gently conned herself into the curious Rapunzel-like role of a pensive girl, somehow magically prisoner among the pines and salt fogs of Kinneret, looking for somebody to say, "Hey, let down your hair." When it turned out to be Pierce, she'd happily pulled out the pins and curlers and down it tumbled in its whispering, dainty avalanche. Only when Pierce had got maybe halfway up, her lovely hair turned, through some sinister sorcery, into a great unanchored wig, and down he fell on his ass. But dauntless, perhaps using one of his many credit cards for a shim, he'd slipped the lock on her tower door and come up the conch-like stairs, which, had true guile come more naturally to him, he'd have done to begin with. But all that had then gone on between them had really never escaped the confinement of that tower. In Mexico City, they somehow wandered into an exhibition of paintings by the beautiful Spanish exile, Remedios Varo. In the central painting of a triptych titled Bordando el Manto Terrestre were a number of frail girls with heart-shaped faces, huge eyes, spun gold hair, prisoners in the top room of a circular tower, embroidering a kind of tapestry which spilled out the slit windows and into a void, seeking hopelessly to fill the void. For all the other buildings and creatures, all the waves, ships, and forests of the earth were contained in this tapestry, and the tapestry was the world. Oedipa, perverse, had stood in front of the painting and cried. No one had noticed. She wore dark green bubble shades. For a moment, she'd wondered if the seal around her sockets were tight enough to allow the tears simply to go on and fill up the entire lens space and never dry. She could carry the sadness of the moment with her that way forever, see the world refracted through those tears, those specific tears, as if indices as yet unfound varied in important ways from cry to cry. She had looked down at her feet and known then, because of a painting, that what she stood on had only been woven together a couple of thousand miles away in her own tower, was only by accident known as Mexico. And so Pierce had taken her away from nothing. There'd been no escape. What did she so desire escape from? Such a captive maiden, having plenty of time to think, soon realizes that her tower, its height and architecture, are like her ego, only incidental, that what really keeps her where she is magic, anonymous and malignant, visited on her from outside and for no reason at all. Having no apparatus except gut fear and female cunning to examine this formless magic, to understand how it works, how to measure its field strength, count its lines of force, she may fall back on superstition, or take up a useful hobby like embroidery, or go mad, or marry a disc jockey. If the tower is everywhere, and the Knight of Deliverance no proof against its magic, what else? Chapter 2. She left Kinneret then, with no idea she was moving toward anything new. Mucho Mas, enigmatic, whistling, "I Want to Kiss Your Feet," a new recording by Sick Dick and the Volkswagens, an English group he was fond of at that time but did not believe in, stood with hands in pockets while she explained about going down to San Narciso for a while to look into Pierce's books and records and confer with Metzger, the co-executor. Mucho was sad to see her go, but not desperate, so after telling him to hang up if Dr. Hilarious called and look after the oregano in the garden which had contracted a strange mold, she went. San Narciso lay further south, near L.A. Like many named places in California, it was less an identifiable city than a grouping of concepts. Census tracts, special-purpose bond-issue districts, shopping nuclei, all overlaid with access roads to its own freeway. But it had been Pierce's domicile and headquarters, the place he'd begun his land speculating in 10 years ago, and so put down the plinth course of capital on which everything afterward had been built, however rickety or grotesque, toward the sky. And that, she supposed, would set the spot apart, give it an aura. But if there was any vital difference between it and the rest of Southern California, it was invisible on first glance. She drove into San Narciso on a Sunday in a rented Impala. Nothing was happening. She looked down a slope, needing to squint for the sunlight, onto a vast sprawl of houses which had grown up altogether, like a well-tended crop, from the dull brown earth. And she thought of the time she'd opened a transistor radio to replace a battery and seen her first printed circuit. The ordered swirl of houses and streets from this high angle sprang at her now with the same unexpected, astonishing clarity as the circuit card had. Though she knew even less about radios than about Southern Californians, there were to both outward patterns a hieroglyphic sense of concealed meaning, of an intent to communicate. There'd seem no limit to what the printed circuit could have told her, if she had tried to find out. So in her first minute of San Narciso, a revelation also trembled just past the threshold of her understanding. Smog hung all round the horizon. The sun on the bright beige countryside was painful. She and the Chevy seemed parked at the center of an odd religious instant, as if on some other frequency, or out of the eye of some whirlwind rotating too slow for her heated skin even to feel the centrifugal coolness of, words were being spoken. She suspected that much. She thought of Mucho, her husband, trying to believe in his job. Was it something like this he felt, looking through the soundproof glass at one of his colleagues with a headset clamped on, and cueing the next record with movement stylized as the handling of chrism, censer, chalice might be for a holy man, yet really tuned into the voice, voices, the music, its message, surrounded by it, digging it, as were all the faithful it went out to. Did Mucho stand outside Studio A looking in, knowing that even if he could hear it, he couldn't believe in it? She gave it up presently, as if a cloud had approached the sun or the smog thickened, and so broken the religious instant, whatever it might have been, started up and proceeded at maybe 70 miles per hour along the singing blacktop onto a highway she thought went toward Los Angeles, into a neighborhood that was little more than the road's skinny right-of-way, lined by auto lots, escrow services, drive-in small office buildings and factories whose address numbers were in the 70 and then 80,000s. She had never known numbers to run so high. It seemed unnatural. To her left appeared a prolonged scatter of wide pink buildings, surrounded by miles of fence, topped with barbed wire and interrupted now and then by guard towers. Soon an entrance whizzed by, 2 60-foot missiles on either side, and the name Yo-Yo Dine lettered conservatively on each nose cone. This was San Narciso's big source of employment, the Galactronics Division of Yo-Yo Dine Incorporated, one of the giants of the aerospace industry. Pierce, she happened to know, had owned a large block of shares, had been somehow involved in negotiating an understanding with the county tax assessor to lure Yo-Yo Dine here in the first place. It was part, he explained, of being a founding father.
Barbed wire again gave way to the familiar parade of more beige, prefab, cinder block office machine distributors, sealant makers, bottled gas works, fastener factories, warehouses, and whatever. Sunday had sent them all into silence and paralysis, all but an occasional real estate office or truck stop. Edipa resolved to pull in at the next motel she saw, however ugly, stillness and four walls having at some point become preferable to this illusion of speed, freedom, wind in your hair, unreeling landscape. It wasn't. What the road really was, she fancied, was this hypodermic needle, inserted somewhere ahead into the vein of a freeway, a vein nourishing the mainliner L.A., keeping it happy, coherent, protected from pain, or whatever passes with a city for pain. But were Edipa some single melted crystal of urban horse, L.A. really would be no less turned on for her absence. Still, when she got a look at the next motel, she hesitated a second. A representation in painted sheet metal of a nymph holding a white blossom towered 30 feet into the air. The sign, lit up despite the sun, said, Echo Quartz. The face of the nymph was much like Oedipus, which didn't startle her so much as a concealed blower system that kept the nymph's gauze chitin in constant agitation, revealing enormous vermilion-tipped breasts and long pink thighs at each flap. She was smiling a lipsticked and public smile, not quite a hooker's, but nowhere near that of any nymph pining away with love, either. Oedipa pulled into the lot, got out and stood for a moment in the hot sun and the dead, still air, watching the artificial windstorm overhead toss gauze in 5-foot excursions. Remembering her idea about a slow whirlwind, words she couldn't hear. The room would be good enough for the time she had to stay. Its door opened on a long courtyard with a swimming pool, whose surface that day was flat, brilliant with sunlight. At the far end stood a fountain with another nymph. Nothing moved. If people lived behind the other doors or watched through the windows, gagged each with its roaring air conditioner, she couldn't see them. The manager, a dropout named Miles, maybe 16, with a beetle haircut and a lapel-less, cuffless, one-button mohair suit, carried her bags and sang to himself, possibly to her. Miles's song. Too fat to froog, that's what you tell me all the time, when you really tryin' to put me down. But I'm hip, so close your big fat lip. Yeah, baby, I may be too fat to froog, but at least I ain't too slim to swim. It's lovely, said Oedipa. But why do you sing with an English accent when you don't talk that way? It's this group I'm in, Miles explained. The Paranoids. We're new yet. Our manager says we should sing like that. We watch English movies a lot for the accent. My husband's a disc jockey. Oedipa, trying to be helpful. It's only a 1,000-watt station, but if you had anything like a tape, I could give it to him to plug. Miles closed the door behind them and started in with a shifty eye. In return for what? Moving in on her. Do you want what I think you want? This is the payola kid here, you know. Oedipa picked up the nearest weapon, which happened to be the rabbit ear antenna off the TV in the corner. Oh, said Miles, stopping. You hate me too. Eyes bright through his bangs. You are a paranoid, Oedipa said. I have a smooth young body, said Miles. I thought you older chicks went for that. He left, after shaking her down for 4 bits for carrying the bags. That night, the lawyer Metzger showed up.
He turned out to be so good-looking that Oedipa thought at first they, somebody up there, were putting her on. It had to be an actor. He stood at her door, behind him the oblong pool shimmering silent in a mild diffusion of light from the nighttime sky, saying, "Mrs. Moss," like a reproach. His enormous eyes, lambent, extravagantly lashed, smiled out at her wickedly. She looked around him for reflectors, microphones, camera cabling, but there was only himself and a debonair bottle of French Beaujolais, which he claimed to have smuggled last year into California, this rollicking lawbreaker, past the frontier guards. "So, hey," he murmured. "After scouring motels all day to find you, I can come in there, can I?" Oedipa had planned on nothing more involved that evening than watching Bonanza on the tube. She'd shifted into her stretched denim slacks and a shaggy black sweater, and had her hair all the way down. She knew she looked pretty good. "Come in," she said. "But I only have one glass." "I," the gallant Metzger let her know, "can drink out of the bottle." He came in and sat on the floor in a suit, opened the bottle, poured her a drink, began to talk. It presently came out that Oedipa hadn't been so far off, thinking it was an actor. Some 20-odd years ago, Metzger had been one of those child movie stars performing under the name of Baby Igor. "My mother," he announced bitterly, "was really out to cashier me. Boy, like a piece of beef on the sink, she wanted me drained and white. Times I wonder," smoothing down the hair at the back of his head, "if she succeeded. It scares me. You know what mothers like that turn their male children into?" "You certainly don't look," Oedipa began, then had second thoughts. Metzger flashed her a big, wry couple rows of teeth. "Looks don't mean a thing anymore," he said. "I live inside my looks, and I'm never sure. The possibility haunts me." "And how often?" Oedipa inquired, now aware it was all words. "Has that line of approach worked for you, Baby Igor?" "Do you know," Metzger said, "Inverarity only mentioned you to me once." "Were you close?" "No, I drew up his will." "Don't you want to know what he said?" "No," said Oedipa, and snapped on the television set. Onto the screen bloomed the image of a child of indeterminate sex, its bare legs pressed awkward together, its shoulder-length curls mingling with the shorter hair of a Saint Bernard, whose long tongue, as Oedipa watched, began to swipe at the child's rosy cheeks, making the child wrinkle up its nose appealingly and say, "Aw, Murray, come on now, you're getting me all wet." "That's me, that's me," cried Metzger, staring. "Good God!" "Which one?" asked Oedipa. "That movie was called," Metzger snapped his fingers, "Cashiered." "About you and your mother?" "About this kid and his father who's drummed out of the British Army for cowardice. Only he's covering up for a friend, see, and to redeem himself, he and the kid follow the old regiment to Gallipoli, where the father somehow builds a midget submarine, and every week they slip through the Dardanelles into the Sea of Marmara and torpedo the Turkish merchantmen, the father, son, and Saint Bernard. The dog sits on periscope watch and barks if he sees anything." Oedipa was pouring wine. "You're kidding. Listen, listen, here's where I sing." And sure enough, the child and dog and a merry old Greek fisherman who had appeared from nowhere with a zither now all stood in front of phony Dodecanese process footage of a seashore at sunset. And the kid sang,
Baby Igor's Song. Gainst the Hun and the Turk, never once do we shirk, my daddy, my doggy, and me. Through the perilous years, like the three musketeers, we will stick just as close as can be. Soon our subs periscopal aim for Constantinople, as again we set hopeful to sea. Once more unto the breach, for those boys on the beach, just my daddy, my doggy, and me.
Then there was a musical bridge featuring the fisherman and his instrument. Then the young Metzger took it from the top, while his aging double, over Oedipa's protests, sang harmony. Either he made up the whole thing, Oedipa thought suddenly, or he bribed the engineer over at the local station to run this. It's all part of a plot, an elaborate seduction plot. Oh, Metzger.
You didn't sing along, he observed.
I didn't know, Oedipa smiled. On came a loud commercial for Fangoso Lagoons, a new housing development west of here.
One of Inverarity's interests, Metzger noted.
It was to be laced by canals with private landings for powerboats, a floating social hall in the middle of an artificial lake, at the bottom of which lay restored galleons imported from the Bahamas, Atlantean fragments of columns and friezes from the Canaries, real human skeletons from Italy, giant clamshells from Indonesia, all for the entertainment of scuba enthusiasts. A map of the place flashed onto the screen. Oedipa drew a sharp breath. Metzger, on the chance it might be for him, looked over. But she'd only been reminded of her look downhill this noontime. Some immediacy was there again. Some promise of hierophany. Printed circuit, gently curving streets, private access to the water. Book of the Dead. Before she was ready for it, back came Cashiered. The little submarine, named the Justine, after the dead mother, was at the quay, singling up all lines. A small crowd was seeing it off, among them the old fisherman and his daughter, a leggy, ringletted nymphet who, should there be a happy ending, would end up with Metzger, an English missionary nurse with a nice build on her, who would end up with Metzger's father, and even a female sheepdog with eyes for Murray the St. Bernard.
"Oh, yeah," Metzger said. "This is where we have trouble in the Narrows. It's a bitch because of the Cafez minefields, but Jerry has also recently hung this net, this gigantic net, woven out of cable 2.5 inches thick."
Oedipa refilled her wine glass. They lay now staring at the screen, flanks just lightly touching. There came from the TV set a terrific explosion.
"Mines!" cried Metzger, covering his head and rolling away from her.
"Daddy," blubbered the Metzger in the tube, "I'm scared."
The inside of the midget sub was chaotic, the dog galloping to and fro, scattering saliva that mingled with the spray from a leak in the bulkhead, which the father was now plugging with his shirt.
"One thing we can do," announced the father. "Go to the bottom. Try to get under the net."
"Ridiculous," said Metzger. "They'd built a gate in it so German U-boats could get through to attack the British fleet. All our E-class subs simply used that gate."
"How do you know that?"
"Wasn't I there?"
"But," began Oedipa, then saw how they were suddenly out of wine.
"Uh-huh," said Metzger, from an inside coat pocket, producing a bottle of tequila.
"No lemons?" she asked, with movie gaiety.
"No salt?"
"A tourist thing.
Did Inverarity use lemons when you were there?"
"How did you know we were there?"
She watched him fill her glass, growing more anti-Metzger as the level rose.
"He wrote it off that year as a business expense. I did his tax stuff.
A cash nexus, brooded Oedipa. You and Perry Mason, two of a kind. It's all you know about, you shysters.
But our beauty lies, explained Metzger, in this extended capacity for convolution. A lawyer in a courtroom in front of any jury becomes an actor, right? Raymond Burr is an actor, impersonating a lawyer, who in front of a jury becomes an actor. Me? I'm a former actor who became a lawyer. They've done the pilot film of a TV series, in fact, based loosely on my career, starring my friend Manny DiPresso, a one-time lawyer who quit his firm to become an actor, who in this pilot plays me, an actor, become a lawyer, reverting periodically to being an actor. The film is in an air-conditioned vault at one of the Hollywood studios. Light can't fatigue it. It can be repeated endlessly.
You're in trouble, Oedipa told him, staring at the tube, conscious of his thigh, warm through his suit and her slacks. Presently,
the Turks are up there with searchlights, he said, pouring more tequila, watching the little submarine fill up. Patrol boats and machine guns. You want to bet on what'll happen?
Of course not, said Oedipa. The movie's made.
He only smiled back.
One of your endless repetitions.
But you still don't know, Metzger said. You haven't seen it. Into the commercial break now roared a deafening ad for Beaconsfield cigarettes, whose attractiveness lay in their filters' use of bone charcoal, the very best kind.
Bones of what? Wondered Oedipa.
Inverarity knew. He owned 51% of the filter process.
Tell me.
Someday. Right now it's your last chance to place your bet. Are they going to get out of it or not?
She felt drunk. It occurred to her, for no reason, that the plucky trio might not get out after all. She had no way to tell how long the movie had to run. She looked at her watch, but it had stopped.
This is absurd, she said.
Of course they'll get out.
How do you know?
All those movies had happy endings.
All?
Most.
That cuts down the probability, he told her, smug.
She squinted at him through her glass. Then give me odds.
Odds would give it away.
So, she yelled, maybe a bit rattled. I bet a bottle of something, tequila, all right, that you didn't make it.
Feeling the words had been conned out of her. That I didn't make it, he pondered. Another bottle tonight would put you to sleep, he decided. No.
What do you want to bet, then?
She knew. Stubborn, they watched each other's eyes for what seemed 5 minutes. She heard commercials chasing one another into and out of the speaker of the TV. She grew more and more angry, perhaps juiced, perhaps only impatient for the movie to come back on.
Fine, then,
she gave in at last, trying for a brittle voice.
It's a bet, whatever you'd like, that you don't make it. That you all turn.